No.
Yes.
Nine o'clock, all right. Open up the, so it should be, as long as you can hold there, but I don't see it on the bottom here, so maybe look at that part. Okay, on the syllabus, first thing that's listed, the instructor who already knew about the volunteer program in previous classes. It's listed as a required textbook. It's actually not required. It's recommended. And again, it depends on your study habits and whether you want supplemental for the chemistry portion. Depending on the chapter, some chapters are better than others. So it depends on, most of what I put on an exam will be in my PowerPoints through my lecture. So if you understand that, then you probably don't need the supplemental, but you know, some people like the reprinting to reinforce what they're learning in a lecture format. So it depends on your study habits as to whether or not you want to buy a book. First policies just came out of the student policy handbook, so those you're familiar with. Examinations can be of any format. I usually use at least some multiple choice, but you can also have other short answer questions. So they don't have to be multiple choice. Dr. Boncher doesn't use multiple choice. As far as exam, you have what's considered like a university-approved excuse, then I would give a makeup. Dr. Boncher really doesn't like to write makeup exams, so she's a lot tougher than I am, so try not to miss exams. But there are things that are not necessarily in your control, so you have to get what's considered a university-approved one. So usually there's, you need some kind of documentation in writing, whatever it is, causing you to miss an exam. Sometimes people have funerals, they have to go through something, or sick, so on. The grading scale is essentially the one that we use in the chemistry classes, or the med chem 1 or 2, or tumor course, we all follow the same grading scale. And then the lecture outline is the next pages. And right off the bat, I have a problem. Next week, I have to go to a curriculum conference, so I'm not going to be here on Wednesday and Friday. So Dr. Potter is going to lecture for 2 hours in pharmacology on Friday. I'm going to lecture 2 hours on Friday to make up one of the lectures. So the 9 o'clock and the 10 o'clock will be MedChem this Friday. Then next week, Dr. Potter will be doubling up and doing the 9 o'clock and the 10 o'clock for pharmacology. And then the following Wednesday, I'll double up and make back my other lectures. So first one that affects you will be this Friday. Again, instead of having pharmacology, it'll be 2 hours of MedChem. Next week, it will be 2 hours of pharmacology on both Wednesday and Friday. When I made up the schedule, I didn't know for sure which days we were switching, so I didn't put that into the schedule, so it doesn't reflect those actual lecture times. Does anyone have any questions on the syllabus portion? Assuming everyone has gotten their packets. There are copies of most of the slides in the packages. The other thing, the packet starts out with a list of the competencies that were developed by AACP to what you should understand from the chemistry aspects as well. And I didn't have my copy with me. But it's trying to explain, you go through a series of compounds. One of the things people have trouble with is when they're on an exam, they may not have the name of the compound. So So you need to be able to look at the structures, figure out what type of activity it has, whatever is relevant to that particular compound. It differs depending on the category of compounds, so I won't make a generalization, but we need to know this for all categories. For instance, with some compounds, categories like, if we get into the anti-coenergy compounds, they are metabolized, but metabolites are generally inactive, so just general routes, you don't need to know for specific compounds. Whereas with some other categories, you form either active metabolites or toxic metabolites, and those will be more important to recognize. So it depends on the category as to which ones are most important. Essentially, you go through the course, you're looking at how does the chemistry affect absorption, distribution, metabolism, excretion, you know, which receptors it interacts with, and so on. So that's what you should be picking up from the class. Setting on the pharmacology sequence is the last time they were offered, so setting on the MedChem 1 and pharmacology 1 this summer. So I'm trying to look at with the new curriculum when we integrate the two courses, you know, where's our overlap? So if I figured out where they're overlapping, then I don't have to cover that material. So it may change a little bit as far as the focus of the content. So now let's see if I can get integrity working. Slide is indicated that it's autonomic and somatic nerves The autonomic system, as you're aware, that sympathetic and parasympathetic system, that's a designation based upon anatomy, not upon a chemical basis. Then we get into the neurotransmitters, which is what we're interested in. And we're interested in the cholinergic system, where acetylcholine is your neurotransmitter. And then, as you're probably aware, there's two different types of cholinergic receptors. We've got muscarinic and nicotinic, and that's what the N and the M is standing for on this slide. So N is a nicotinic receptor, M is a muscarinic receptor. Nicotinic receptors are involved in the ganglia. They're also found in the adrenal medulla, where you release epinephrine and norepinephrine. And then you also have nicotinic receptors in the skeletal muscles, think in terms of voluntary movement. Pharmacology will be spending a lot of time on looking at the specific effects from interacting with nicotinic receptors and different muscarinic receptors. So this is an overview. When we get into the material in the second test, we'll be looking at the epinephrine and norepinephrine effects. So we're looking at the sympathetic system, or is releasing them from the adrenal medulla. Lines that are showing in the vesicles as well as in the synapse. are proteins that are involved in the fusion process. So we have the fusion of proteins in the vesicle that goes in the synapse, and that's what's inhibited by botulism toxin. Essentially what it does is remove two amino acids from the protein, so then the vesicles won't fuse with the synapse. And we're not going to focus on this at all, but it's just, you're familiar with using it, use it like you take wrinkles and so on. It's got some therapeutic uses, but we're not going to talk about it. But that's essentially what it does. It prevents the fusion of the vesicles from the synapse, so acetylcholine's not released. Okay, once you release acetylcholine into the synapse, it can react with the receptors. So these receptors here can be either nicotinic or muscarinic, depending on the location. The action of acetylcholine is terminated with the acetylcholinesterase enzyme, which hydrolyzes it. That's what this is representing. So you hydrolyze it, form choline and acetate, which are inactive on the receptors. The choline then is recycled. So it comes back here and you reuse it. Normally the choline keeps recycling. The release of neurotransmitters can be regulated by either autoreceptors or heteroreceptors. Autoreceptors means it's the same compound being released that inhibits the release. In the case of acetylcholine, these are usually muscarinic receptors, 1-2 receptors. You can also have other compounds that affect the release. When we get into the adrenergic system and we start looking at epinephrine, norepinephrine, norepinephrine can be terminated by reuptake. We don't take acetylcholine back into the neuron to reuse it. Terminated by hydrolyzing. We get into the mechanism of actions of compounds that have therapeutic utility. One of the things we can do is to inhibit the acetylcholinesterase enzyme. So that will increase the duration of acetylcholine being available to the receptors. The enzyme that's going to hydrolyze it is your acetylcholine esterase. That's what you find in the synapse. It has a serine in the active site. So that's why that's represented here. Serine, if you're familiar with from biochemistry, has an alcohol or its side chain. That alcohol will attack the carbonyl on the acetyl portion of acetylcholine. So you form this tetrahedral transition state. The first products that are formed will be the release of the choline, and then you have the acetylated enzyme that's covalently attached to the acetyl portion. The enzyme is now inactive, and then that undergoes hydrolysis to regenerate the enzyme and form your second product, the acetate. So the enzyme can now come back and catalyze the hydrolysis of the next molecule. This is a very rapid process when looking at reacting with acetylcholine. This is just an overview. When you release the acetylcholine from the vesicles, this says 12,000 to 60,000. References differ as to the number of molecules of acetylcholine released. I saw one that said anywhere from 1,000 to 50,000. So it's not the absolute number that's important. Just the idea is it's not just one molecule that's released. It's thousands of molecules at a time. And then the other thing is you don't just release the contents of one vesicle when you have a nerve impulse. You can release the contents from several hundred vesicles. So the net effect is what you're doing is you're plugging the synapse area with the acetylcholine. It's hard to study the rate at which humans would hydrolyze it, but they can do this in rats. So what they're looking at here is if you look at how much is released with one impulse, you can release something like 3 times 10 to the 6 molecules into the synapse at one time. Then if you look at how fast can they hydrolyze the acetylcholine, the main thing here is it's about 100 times faster in a millisecond than the amount that's released. So again, that's a very rapid process normally. So you don't have acetylcholine sitting in the synapse for any period of time. When we look at compounds that can affect the system, we'll be looking at compounds that can be either agonists or antagonists. So either compounds that mimic the acetylcholine, or we can have compounds that will block the receptors. When we look at compounds that produce an agonist type of effect, we can have two different types. We can have compounds that are referred to as direct acting, meaning they're interacting with the receptors. And then we can have compounds that inhibit the hydrolysis of acetylcholine, and then it's acetylcholine that reacts with the receptor. These are your indirect acting compounds. The significance of this is that acetylcholine is not selective. It's going to interact with both nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. And we don't always want both types of actions. We usually are looking for a more selective effect. So when you get into compounds that are direct acting, they can be more selective. They don't have to. So we can get compounds that have just a muscarinic effect and have compounds that have just a nicotinic effect. So that can be an advantage. When we get into the antagonist, again, we can selectively block the muscarinic receptors or selectively block the nicotinic receptors. You don't have this one in your handout, but it's from that basic clinical pharmacology text. I will give you a copy of it. But it's summarizing what was on that just previous slide. So we are looking at the compounds that produce a stimulatory effect. It can be direct acting, and these compounds can be divided into the compounds that are alkaloids, meaning they don't necessarily look like acetylcholine, versus those that resemble the Seal of Hope, the esters or the aromatics, so on. Those are the compounds that can interact directly on the receptor. Again, they can be either selective or non-selective. So they can interact with both types of receptors, or the compounds that are selective for one or the other. You must limit versus a negative. The other compounds that can produce the effect again, the acetylcholine esterase inhibitors end up increasing the amount of acetylcholine, which reacts with the receptors. Again, if you're looking at acetylcholine, that's non-selective. It'll stimulate both types of receptors. When we get into the acetylcholine esterase inhibitors, they divide them into reversible and irreversible based on their chemistry, whether they're carbamates or phosphates. When we get into the nicotinic receptors, again, there's a difference in the receptors in the neuromuscular junction versus in the ganglion. This is a review slide. We learned about receptors in the drug action course. These are your different categories of receptors. The ones that we're going to be focusing on when we look at the cholinergic agents will be ion channels and the G-protein coupled receptors. So the nicotinic receptor is an ion channel. With an ion channel, you end up having different subunits, and it's embedded into a membrane, which you'll see in a few minutes. And you end up having a pore that will be selected for certain types of ions. G-protein coupled receptors will be important when we study drugs. The references differ, but they figure maybe about 60% of drugs that you will study end up having receptors that are G-protein coupled receptors. So understanding the mechanism will be important. Muscarinic, G-protein coupled receptors, nicotinic, ion channels. When you look at ion channels, you can have voltage regulated ion channels, or you can have ligand activated ion channels. And when we're looking at the nicotinic receptor, the acetylcholine is what normally opens the core, and that's the ligand that binds to the receptor. It's a transmitter gated ion channel. We'll see in a minute there are different types of muscarinic receptors. We have like five different categories. There's different categories of nicotinic receptors. But for most of the drugs that we'll look at, just knowing if they're muscarinic or nicotinic is what you need to know. With the agonists, we're not going to have too much of a separation of compounds as far as activating them. When we get into antagonists, there will be a little bit more selectivity for some of the muscarinic receptors, but when we're looking at agonists, they're usually not selective. They interact with muscarinic versus nicotinic, but they don't distinguish the muscarinic receptors. So where the receptors got their name was based on alkaloids that they discovered that had certain types of action. So the first one you're looking at is muscarine, structure shown. Yeah, it's a natural product. It's an alkaloid. Produces some of the actions of acetylcholine, but not all of them. So the actions that are similar to what you see with acetylcholine are the ones that are referred to as muscarinic. If you look at the structure of the compound, I think I have a CPS question for you. Since you don't have your CPS unit yet, you won't necessarily look at this question. But if you looked at the structure, you have three chiral centers. So we've got two of the third columns, so we've got eight different isomers. Of the eight isomers, one has activity on the receptors. You need a certain stereochemistry to bind to the receptors and activate them. little bit of information on the muscarinic receptors. We have five different categories. They're synthesized from different genes, so they have different structures as far as the sequence of amino acids. They differ in where they're produced, how much is produced. They do have different functions. When we look at the muscarinic receptors, we're going to essentially have two different types of secondary messengers. So you have your phospholipase C. That's the secondary site from interacting with the G protein or changing the action of the adenyl cyclase. Compounds can differ, but again, agonists usually are not very selective for one type of muscarinic receptor. It will interact with all of them, but you can see more of a selectivity with the antagonist. We do have a supplemental sheet. If you want to look at that for a minute, it's got the five different types of muscarinic receptors on the top of it. When you look at the receptors, one group of five are similar to one another, and then two and four are similar to one another. So if you look at one, three, and five, they all do the same thing. They stimulate the phospholipase C for mechanism. Two and four inhibit the adenyl cyclase for mechanism. One, three, and five are similar. Two and four are similar. Locations, I think Dr. Potter will talk more about that. They're all found in the CNS. Again, when we're looking at the agonist, we're generally going to end up stimulating all of them. We're not going to have a selective action. The antagonists that are listed there, atropine will be a compound that's an antagonist to all of the muscarinic receptors. So it's non-selective. And then you'll see some other compounds listed, and some of the structures are shown in the middle of the page. They're selective antagonists. So you don't have to memorize these particular compounds, but again, they can give compounds that are antagonists that are selective easier than they can give compounds that are agonists. The structure that's in the center represents the G protein coupled receptor, and we'll look at that in just a minute. The part on the bottom is just showing you some of the different types of nicotinic receptors. We'll talk about those in a few minutes. Yeah, this is just an overview structure on how G protein receptors work. The G protein receptors have the compound listed to reflect the hormone, but we're going to be looking at acetylcholine being the compound that binds to the receptor. The receptor is going to span the channel. And then inside the cell is where we have the G protein. The G protein binds GTP, so it got its name. And when it binds to the GTP, you have the dissociation of these subunits, and you get the compound that actually produces the effect. These are some of the different secondary messengers that can be produced from G protein coupled receptors. Some of the abbreviations that you'll see are listed on this slide. When we look at the muscarinic receptors again, remember that 1, 3, and 5 are interacting with the phospholipase C, and it's using the phosphatidylinositol 4,5-methylphosphate as its substrate. The two products that are formed are listed, so they're the ones that are actually producing the effect. The 2 for, affect the activity of annual cycling, so cycle need a fee that changes. Little bit on the M1 receptors. This is responsible for a lot of the side effects from other therapeutic classes. We'll tell here the anticholinergic side effects. So if we block this receptor, we see side effects from compounds like some of our CNS compounds like antidepressants and so on. So anticholinergic side effects are very common side effects. Yeah, Dr. Potter will spend more time on the specific actions of the different receptors. As I mentioned, all of the muscarinic receptors you find out in the categories can be CNS. So some of the ones that are important, the TM1 are listed here. More closely at that binding. or reproduce it, or look at it when you're interacting, and you look at the effect of that. One thing with this one is it's showing that the tyrosine and the threonine are on the same level, which isn't what this was saying. Here it was saying we were on 5 mg. Which is showing they're both on 5. The activity of two proteins is tightly controlled. So this just, again, shows you a general mechanism. The creature G protein initially, if the GDG bound to it, then the compound interacts with its receptor on the external side, and this does show acetylcholine. That causes a conformational change. So the GDP is displaced and now GTP combined. And GTP binds to the dissociation of the subunits. And to terminate the effect, we're going to have to hydrolyze the GTP back to GDP, and the other subunits can reassociate and go back to the inactive receptor. This is just the general mechanism of the steps that have occurred. Mentioned 1, 3, and 5 activate phospholipase 6, so they're all doing the same thing. So they have similar mechanisms. And this just shows you the structure of the secondary messengers. Same thing with the structure of the secondary messengers. These are covalent compounds, so they stay inside the cell. They're not going to diffuse out of the cell to produce an effect. And this one doesn't show up very good in the notes, but it's a more colorful one. Yeah, acetylcholine binds to its external binding site for the two protein coupled receptor. And inside, we have the GTP being able to bind, which activates the receptor. And the receptor can produce the effect. This is showing the production of the products, and that's what leads to your pharmacological and therapeutic effects, physiological effects. 2 and 4, mentioned they're similar. They both inhibit adenyl cyclase, so they're going to decrease the amount of cyclic AMP. Decrease in cyclic AMP leads to a decrease in muscle contraction. They're going to be located in different locations in the body. So like the M2 located in the heart, M4 in smooth muscle, secretory glands. So they have different locations. And in addition to regulating the synthesis of cyclic AMP, we have to also consider its hydrolysis. We're not going to be covering them, but we have compounds that can inhibit the phosphodiesterase, which is what hydrolyzes your cyclic AMP. So if you inhibit phosphodiesterases, you can increase cyclic AMP of your mechanism. We're looking at inhibiting the adenyl cyclase, so we'll decrease the synthesis of the cyclic AMP to produce that effect. This just gives you an indication of some of the effects from the M2 and M4 receptors. Yeah, pharmacology will spend more time on the different receptors. I don't think we have this one, but this is just a summary of the mechanism that we just went through. Yeah, M2 and M4, inhibit adenyl cyclase, 1, 3, and 5, activate phospholipase C, and then attach and produce this one for you. I don't think that this one here, but it's looking at the different categories of receptors. skip this one for you. The main thing here is acetylcholine is the agonist on all of the different muscarinic receptors. We really don't have selective agonists. Atropine is an antagonist on all the muscarinic receptors. We can have selective antagonists. Mechanism, this is shown for M1 and 3 and 5. It's affecting the formation, the IQ3, and the 2 and 4, decreasing cycle A and B. And this just gives you some of the major locations for the receptors. My purpose is you don't have to worry about learning these pharmacology.